trapeze language is too much. So the light is anomalously doubled, just as the initiatory process is presided over by his monstrous double. The bull-shaped youth, whom he now sees before him, is a symbolical projection of his own unintegrated animality. It's not just the animality. It's his own mythic meaning in a ritual level that is now loosened. It isn't a part of him anymore. And like, if one could speak psychologically for a moment, the ego has absolutely no control over projection. None whatsoever. It's a distinguishing mark that the ego doesn't know when projection takes place at all. Someone else has to tell you. And the damnable thing is that you usually don't believe someone else. Oh, that can't be me. Oh, well, you're making this up, you see, like that. So the scene ends with hints that he is going to be handed over to his mother to be carried as an infant. In fact, what does she do? She, after he's torn apart, she comes back to Thebes carrying just his head. She thinks it's the head of a calf. The head of a sacrificial animal. Yes, it's the sacrificial animal that projected aspect of her own son, which she has participated in murdering. Why? Why does she murder? The mother always is the murderer of this projection. Why? Because on the deep mythic level, the mother is the mother for the whole son. And will reject the incomplete, arrogant image of the son, thinking that this will restore the real son, the wholeness of the son. It is the mother image that murders the projected arrogant role of the son. Always happens. Don't think too hard on it, but in this is a deep theological mystery also. But this potential rebirth also ends in disaster and disintegration when that mother takes the lead in tearing him apart as a beast hunted in the wild. We may contrast the birth and mystic rebirth of Dionysus and his followers. Pentheus's dressing as a female Maenad may well reflect initiatory ritual still familiar to Euripides and his audience. At the ritual of the Ochophoria, two young men called Paides put on girl's dress and led a procession from the sanctuary of Dionysus in Athens to a shrine of Athena in Phaleron, outside the city. A somewhat similar ephebic change of dress seems to have taken place at the Dionysiac celebration of the Anastheria. That's a spring festival when they would put on the plays. You must understand that Euripides' sophisticated drama at the very end of the development of Greek tragedy is remembering the primitive beginnings of Greek tragedy in the Dionysiac goat dances of some two or three centuries before. Is a very, very great work of art. He's able to present quite accurately that this development has been presaged because of the way the seed was planted in the first place. That we at our high level of achievement are victims of the way in which the achievement was planned for from the first insight. The first insight was flawed. And our fruit is an accurate development of that flawed insight. The great tragedy in Euripides' Bacchae is the realization that classical Greek civilization was flawed at the structural level. They never had a chance at fullness. This, incidentally, led to the rejection of this whole sophisticated network. In other words, there was almost like a social suicide. After the time of the Bacchae, Athens never again was anything more than a little university town. Not much more. It had about as much importance in civilization as Oxford, England would have in the British Empire of the 1980s. It's an interesting tourist stop, and that's all. The psychic energy broke. As Arnold Toynbee said, when you have a failure of nerve, you can never recover. You have to transform and reconstruct from the basis again. You can't glue the psyche back together. You can't adjust it. You have to reforge it. You have to remake it. You have to melt it back down in the fires, the refining fires of the deep self, and reforge it, remake it, rebirth. Once life has been torn apart, you can't glue it back together and have life. At the best, one would have a Frankenstein. You must understand that Shelley understood this very accurately. In Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, she got the idea from her husband and from Lord Byron that this is the perfect image of the new man, is that he hopes to glue together a superior being by taking the best parts from different people and amalgamating it. And one only gets a Frankenstein from that. The only way to have a better person is to reforge oneself in the fires of your own reality. Dionysius' own shifting between male and female garb in both cultic and literary presentations suggests his role in such initiatory practices. The initiatory meaning of such acts in Greek myth is also clear from the story of Achilles hidden as a girl among the maidens on Scyros. In the case of Pentheus, this cultic significance fuses with religious meaning. The acceptance of the female emotionality of the Dionysiac cult and psychological meaning. The youth's coming to terms with his own feminine side and with the problem of behavior towards women. In other words, what happens in a projection, if the projection is really energized, it takes whatever is the dominant mode of the ego and leaves behind the subordinate mode of the ego. If one projects a feminine role, one leaves an unconscious masculine role which is ungrounded to it. If one projects a masculine role, one leaves a feminine. Incidentally, the whole observation of someone like Carl Jung that women have an anima, a masculine soul, and men have an anima, a female soul, unfortunately is diagnostic of the sickness of our times. It's not true at all. But the fact that Jung would see that was just, it's like an accurate expressing of the symptom of the sickness of the civilization. He thought it was a universal structure. It's just a symptom of the actual disease of the time. This ritual, like the others in the play, undergoes a massive inversion. The initiate takes on the very attributes of his alter ego that he most scorns, the Jekyll and Hyde thing. Why so? Because the balance has been a mechanical balance. It's been a gluing together. And when the projection of the one role is put out, the balance is broken, and the unconscious compensation comes to dominate the ego in that absence. Where will such an imbalanced, compulsive egotism, where will it focus itself? It'll focus itself on warring with its own projection. Exactly. When Pentheus's mother, Ague, kills her son, she thinks that she is doing a wonderful thing in killing this wild beast. She did not recognize her own son, because her own son had become a wild beast, really, in terms of the mother's eyes. It's a very, very interesting in and out. So that the initiate takes on the very attributes of his alter ego that he most scorns: hunted beast instead of hunter, barbarian instead of Greek, female instead of male. He loses rather than gains a place in the city and its political life. He acts out the opposite of the values of his male peer group: effeminacy instead of masculinity, emotionality instead of rationality, illusion, magic, and trickery instead of realistic clarity, forthrightness, and martial discipline. So that this produces a fluttering of the mind, Siegel will go on to say. Now, Siegel also, unfortunately, is a little limited here, doesn't fully grasp the deep mystery of this. One can't identify the kind of magic energy with woman and the kind of rational energy with male. This is false identification. That's not the truth in the matter. The truth in the matter is that they are qualities which only come into opposition when they have been braided out by a false process of discrimination. In their actual occurrence, in the deep self, they are not two different strands at all. There's no such thing as strands. In the deep self, there's just the pool of the fabric without any threads, warp or woven. But the process of discrimination makes the threads occur, makes these qualities seem as if they are attributes of threads that can then be unwoven. And this is the very essence of why art is indispensable. Art weaves the threads back together, and once done so, the fabric is a whole. It is no longer warp and woof, but it is the fabric. And so art is the actual expression of the deep self in terms of its coherency. All the threads and all the designs put back together and expressed. So that a work of art is really personal, just in the same way that the person is really an accurate expression of their deep self. A mature person doesn't have to find one's deep self. How they live in their fullness, that is the deep self. There is no difference. There is no montage effect which can be discriminated. The old Rosicrucian way of expressing this was, the life lived is the doctrine received. Or as Benjamin Franklin said, that he noted that most people who got into religious bickering were over doctrines. And that the thing that he looked for was to see how people lived, and that was good enough for him as determining what doctrines they actually held. It's a very accurate way of speaking. Let's end before the break. Let's come back to Mallarmé. Remember now that Mallarmé is presenting us symbolically with the pendulum. He sees it from the mythic angle, so that the magic of consciousness is like a shimmering mystery And yet at the same time, from the conscious angle, where the mythic image quality is disjointed and doesn't really hold a shape. But his poetry excellently gives us both together, so that the reader is put into a position where he is indecisive of taking one aspect or the other, and if taking the whole poem, then comes to have a realization. Mallarmé, like James Joyce, would have used the term epiphany, the Greek term epiphany for this. The epiphany of the reader is that his reading the poem makes the poem. It's not the structure of the poem that makes the poem. It's not the content of the structure of the poem that is the poem. It's the reader reading the poem that makes the poem. Wallace Stevens' famous line, "Thou art not august unless I say make thee so." Or in the idea of order at Key West, about the young woman walking alongside the ocean shore and they wondering about what is real here. And Stevens writes, she sang beyond the sea, and whatever self the sea had, she singing made. This is Mallarmé, and we'll end with this. The very poem is about this very process of confusion between mythic image and symbolic import, and how the poem does not resolve them in favor of one or the other, but the poem presents the two of them together, and the reader, in making the poem work, is the resolution. The bizarre chamber in this frame, the pomp of warring centuries with the tarnished gold work, is like old snows instead of its former color, and its tapestry with nacreous luster, futile folds, with the shrouded eyes of sibyls offering their aged fingernails to the mages. One of them with embroideries of flowers on my robe, bleached in the closed ivory, with a sky of birds strewn on the blackened silver, seems garbed in risen flights, and like a phantom, an aroma reaching. Oh, roses, an aroma, far from the empty bed hidden by a snuffed candle, an aroma of cold bones lingering on the sachet, a bunch of flowers unfaithful to the moon. By the dead candle it still sheds its petals. Flowers whose long regret and stems are steeped in a lone vase whose brightness is bedimmed. A dawn was dragging her wings among the tears. Sorcerer shadow with symbolic charms, a voice long drawn, evocative of the past. Is it mine, ready for the incantation, languishing among the yellowed folds of thought, and aged as a cloth perfumed with incense over a pile of cold church vessels? Arises through the ancient holes and through the stiffened folds, matching the rhythm and pure lacework of the shroud that lets the desperate old veiled brilliance mount through its meshes. Oh, what hidden distance in these calls. The old veiled brilliance of a strange vermilion, of the languishing voice, toneless, without acolyte. Will it cast its gold among the final splendors, still the antiphony of petitioning verses, in the hour of agony, in the death struggles? Such is the power of silence and black darkness. Small return likewise to the ancient past. Monotonous, prophetic, weary, vanquished, as the water of ancient basins grows resigned. Even in English translation, Mallarmé is great. if I'm packing it a little full today, it's because I know that you can refer to the tapes. And I usually try to steer clear of more high-powered ideas and intellectual conceptions, not because they can't be given. They most certainly can be given, and my whole background is to give those very things. But in this educational process, I try not to outdistance our ability to hear with the capacity to speak. Just a few more notations here. Siegel's book on Dionysiac poetics in Euripides Bacchae, I think, is still available from Princeton. We have it here, and you can avail yourselves. We have about 70 volumes on Euripides here. Under this chapter, Meta-Tragedy, a section on reversibility and change, an important notion here, reversibility and then change. The colloquial phrase of being chewed up is literally indicative of the reversibility dilemma. The teeth grind in opposite ways and you get chewed up. But change is not being chewed up. Now, we are used to the kind of 1930s intellectuals that stress transformation, and we get all of that kind of a language. But change is probably a little bit better to work with here as a word and as an idea than transformation. The Greek word for change is morphe, M-O-R-P-H-E, morphe. Metamorphosis. So that transformation is change on a meta level. So that transformation is a metaphorical occurrence and not the actual occurrence. The actual occurrence is change, as in morphosis. And morphe particularly to the Greek mind, and we get the whole idea and usage of the language from the Greek usage. Morphe is the change, is the shape which is able to be changed. Morphe is the shape which is able to be changed. The shape can be changed. The form does not change, but the shape can be changed. So that when we use the term in the latter half of the 20th century of transformation of self, it's actually intellectual gobbledygook, unless you're a mystic. It isn't transformation, but it's changing the shape, as in the wonderful phrase that the great sociologist Irving Goffman used to use in the presentation of everyday of the self in everyday life. You change the way that you're living, that you present yourself in the world. You find a more legitimate role which you can play in your life. And it isn't so much reversibility as in giving up the old, but in modifying and changing the shape of the old. Now, to characterize this as transformation is overkill. Yes, it happens sometimes. And in very deep religious revelations, people do have transformation. But mostly, it's just a change of the shape. The change of shape to the Greeks, though, was particularly a divine characteristic, and if man was able to do it, it was only because God had given this as a gift to man. you don't change your shape on your own recognizance, but because the divine has given you this gift, you are able to do it. But notice that the very workings of this language predispose one to still staying locked into the mythology of the gods. If you're out of the mythology of the gods, you don't have this access, you don't have this gift, you're not able to change your shape. So it's a do or die transformation and nothing. This is the dilemma, the tragic dilemma of consciousness, is the inability to believe in the gods anymore, so that you don't have any leeway to modify yourself, and the only thing that you can do is this radical transformation. And usually what happens, like in Greek tragedies, is the drama, the dramatic showing that this is not possible. That what happens instead of change is not transformation, but the reversibility. The complement to the change comes into play. And what is caught? One is caught on the ambitions of one's own petard, as it were. So here Siegel writes beautifully, the Bacchae not only enacts a situation of massive reversal, but also calls attention to the logical structures overturned in that reversal. This aspect of the play has been sufficiently described above in connection with the ambiguity of the tragic hero. It has another dimension in the play's concern with the instability, uncertainty, and deceptiveness of external form. Why is external form deceptive? Why is it unstable? Why is it uncertain? One is projected out onto external form, that very precarious aspect of oneself. Why? Because you're not dealing very well with it here. So it goes out there. Oh, well, the world is unstable. The world is uncertain. It's a very universal characteristic. The whole Chinese Book of Changes, to codify in some ingenious way the principles of change, comes out of the fall of the Shang Dynasty. The Shang Dynasty, which is symbolically characterized by the great bronzes. The Chinese in the Shang Dynasty thought, we have eternal forms which we can make, which are always going to be here. And the fact that whole civilization crumbled in one generation, the whole Shang Dynasty fell apart in one generation. And the very next generation are the ones who make the I Ching, remake the I Ching in man's image. The King Wen version of the I Ching is remaking the old Fuxi cosmological image into a new man-centered, human experience-centered view of change founded on experience of transformation. The Greeks were unable to do this in the 4th century BC. The 11th century Chinese, you can find the record of those brilliant people in the Chinese classic, the Book of Songs, the Shi Qing. And in the Book of Songs, you find them referring to the glorious men of Zhou, the Zhou dynasty that replaced the Shang. They're the golden persons because they're really, they were able to not only put it together again, they didn't glue the Shang culture back together again, but they made a new glorious culture. A whole new kind of thing. And the Greeks were unable to do this. They did not do this. So that the play, the Bacchae, has this other dimension in the play's concern with the instability, uncertainty, and deceptiveness of external form. Through its language and action, the play calls attention to that shift between appearance and reality that is so fundamental a theme to all Greek tragedy. Not only to Greek tragedy, but to our sense of person making. The Greek understanding of the psyche, for good or for ill, has been the template upon which all cognate cultures since, including the contemporary Far East, have based the language of self-development, person-making. Now, if you lived in a time or a culture where the person wasn't that important, it wasn't that imperative, it didn't come into play that much. But wherever the person comes into play, that psychic template is active. We're witnessing today, this week, in China, a massive rejection by the young Chinese students of the whole tradition by which China has always been formed. The Chinese students are not just clamoring for democracy, they're saying that this must be a person-based experience of culture and not an ideological projected base, no matter how contemporary the ideology is, that the whole form is being rejected. It's keying in this person-making quality. So these are world issues. Siegel writes of the Bacchae, the play presents a change of dress and appearance on the stage, as striking as that, as any that takes place in Greek drama. It is also deliberately stressing the multiplicity and fluidity of forms that belong to the god who controls the power of illusion. Literal changes of shape or form occur on the stage, Pentheus from king to maenad, to severed head. There's not just a change to woman's dress, but then there's a change that is just the head left, symbolically, you see. Dionysius from the Lydian stranger to the Olympian god. Siegel writes, the language, too, insistently dwells on terms for change and shape. Of the five times that Euripides uses the choral tag, many the shapes of the things of the gods to end the play, nowhere is it more literally appropriate than here. The very form or shape, morphe, of the god is an active element in the plot, as it is in the character and cult of Dionysius himself. The fluid reality to which he leads his worshippers is that of Bacchic ecstasy and also that of tragedy. In other words, the very theater in which Greek tragedies were performed is often, in Athens it was called the Theater of Dionysius. Is the very place. In other words, there is a direct correlate between the Bacchic fluidity of form and the tragic dilemma. The two are cognate occurrences. And where are they cognate occurrences? In the imbalance between consciousness in the mind and feeling tone in the psyche. For those who have been coming to the Pythagoras, of course, as you recognize, the great genius in the Pythagorean tradition of showing that the mind and the psyche are distinct, but when braided together, are indissoluble. The very essence of the Pythagorean tradition, that if the images in the mind are not of trees and flowers, but of the eternal forms, the numbers, then the relationalities between the numbers are the exact relations between the morphe, between the shapes, no matter what they are. And this was the classic resolution, but of course it was put into a hidden order, a mystery religion, and not transmitted publicly at all. The vast public simply fell apart, and they certainly did. And incidentally, the falling apart of the Greek mind was passed on intact. The disease was passed on intact to the Romans, and the Romans fell apart just like the Greeks did some centuries later. And it took longer for it to work its way out. Whereas Athens fell in one generation, it took about 200 years for Rome to fall, but it fell for the very same reason. Very, very same reason. What was the reason? No one could become a person anymore. And everyone became crippled in the sense that they're dependent upon regressive tendencies that more and more became tyrannical. The great historian Livy, writing in 50 BC, already said, we can neither stand the illness that we are, nor the cure necessary to cure it. So you're caught between a rock and a hard place. The fluid reality, writes Hegel, to which he leads his worshippers is that of Bacchic ecstasy, and also that of tragedy. The god appears in a multiplicity of shapes whose function, fluctuation, all of his shapes are in this fluctuation between reality and imagination. Now what is the cure? What is the cure in wholeness for too much imagination? One will say with Siegel here that it's reality. But you can never balance imagination with, quote, the real, because the real always becomes metaphorical only, whereas the imagination is still psychically active. What balances the imagination is memory. And the cure for imagining who you are is to remember who you really are. Then that is real. That delivers the real. But to try and balance the imagined self with the real self is an abstract metaphorical presentation of the dynamics and never works out. Imagination always will win, always will reach this away, because the metaphorical quality of the real has no place to be. With the imagination digs itself into the very feeling-toned guts of the way in which one lives. You can have all the ideas of good that you want, but if you're trembling, those ideas aren't going to stop you from trembling. I've been there. It does no good at all. It has no effect whatsoever. It is memory which balances the imagination. That's Dionysius coming up. No, it won't give up. You better move the flowers so they'll blow over on you. So there's a fluctuation between reality and the imagination, writes Siegel. It's actually a fluctuation between memory and imagination. It's much more correct, with all due respect. He transforms the human characters into new shapes, physically on stage in the case of Pentheus, mythically in the future of Cadmus that he prophesies at the end, and figuratively in the changed mental states that release suppressed desires or the hidden dark side of personality in the case of Pentheus and Ague. In this role, the god mirrors the metamorphic power of the poet himself. The poet himself. The poet holds in himself and reveals to others through his art the kaleidoscopic many shapes of divine things. This is a phrase from Euripides. The many shapes of divine things. What is the truth of divinity? The truth is that divinity has many shapes. No one of the shapes sums it up. No one of the shapes is the real. The reality is that all of these shapes are the divine. There's no limitation to the divine whatsoever in terms of morphe. so that it doesn't matter what shape you choose to be your salvation, the fact that you chose a shape is wrong. It sets you up for the denouement, as the Greek phrase would be, for the fall. The religious epiphany is to realize the old phrase, God will be what God will be. And there's nothing that you can do to force a limitation on that reality. So that the truth in the matter is to accept the protean aspect of the divine and to live with it. So that there is this kind of an odd sense. Now, let's go to Euripides and see what is the moment of remembrance. The only character in the Bacchae who is able to remember is the mother of Pentheus, the very person who tore him apart, led the Bacchae to tear him apart. How does the mother remember? And we have this wonderful, wonderful presentation here where she remembers because she is talking with her father and her father is trying to get her to remember, and Euripides gives us the moment of remembrance. In the Penguin Classics, I'm going to read from the bottom of 220 over to the top of 222, about a page and a half. Enter Cadmus with attendants bearing the body of Pentheus. Cadmus says, "Come, men, bring your sad burden that was Pentheus. Bring him to his home. I found the fragments of his body scattered in a thousand places, no two together." And notice that Pentheus' body is like the fragmented whole. What is fragmented? The worldly surface tension where it once was together and now is seemingly scattered. The light of the star that's blurred by moving the surface tension of the water. The water is a mirror which can be quivered. Incidentally, the psyche also, when stretched to that ultimate tauntness, shows that it isn't a mirror, but it's a pool, because the images can quiver. The images do, in fact, quiver at that tension, if you can stand it, and it's like a proof that the psyche isn't a mirror at all. There's like a reflective surface of a fluid. What is that fluid? The fluid is the morphological profundity of the divine. I found his body scattered in a thousand places, no two together, about the glens of Mount Cithaeron, or hidden in thick woods, and with weary search I gathered them and have brought them here. I had already returned with old Tiresias from the Bacchic dance and was inside the walls of the city when news was brought me of my daughter's terrible deed. I turned straight back to the mountain, and here I bring my son, killed by the Minads. I saw his aunt Autonoe, who bore Actaeon to Aristaeus, and her sister Inyo there among the copses. That's a bunch of trees. Still in their unhappy frenzy. But I understand that Ague came raving towards the palace. It is true, there she is. What a terrible sight. And then Ague comes in, bearing the head of her son, which he thinks is a trophy. Father, you may boast as loudly as you will that no man living is so blessed in his daughters. I mean all three, but myself especially. I have left weeping.